You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hello, everyone. It's Fran here, and I'm here with Sean Winter again. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Fran. Good to be back.
Now, it's Pentecost 22, or proper 25 this week, and we're going to be focusing on Job 42, 1 to 6 and 10 to 17. And Mark 10, 46 to 52.
Back in Job and back in Mark.
Back in Job. So, yes, this is our last week in Job.
Yeah, it's the ending of the book. Yeah, that's right.
So it strikes me that with this ending, we've got at the narrative level a happily ever after dynamic going on, but at the pastoral level, a minefield, and at the theological level, a certain contradiction with what's been going before. So all his friends have said, you know, your suffering must have happened because you did terrible things. And Job has stood up to that.
Yep.
And God has also rejected that.
Yep.
And yet here Job seems to be being rewarded with twice as much wealth and family.
And the most beautiful daughters in the whole world. That's right, yeah.
So there's a lot here.
Well, I think it's a challenging passage, and it's a really challenging way to conclude the book of Job. If you read the book of Job through, I mean, maybe not in one sitting, but you know, if you wrestle with this kind of anguished struggle with the relationship between God and divine providence and the realities of human experience and suffering, if you struggle with those and take them seriously, this does feel like a bit of a kind of cheap
or a cop out
ending of some sort. And everyone, I mean, commentators on Job constantly worry about this. The first thing that people usually point out is that verses 1 to 6 feel much more consistent with what Job has been saying and speaking. In other words, what Job comes to the conclusion is that he doesn't run the world. He's not in control of things. God is who God is, and he who is who he is. And there's a promise in a very famous verse back in chapter 19 where Job holds on to the faith that, you know, I will see God. And at the end is...
He does.
He does see God as God addresses Job. So verses 1 to 6 kind of sit there, but then you've got this narrative ending, which of course corresponds to the narrative introduction of
the upright
of the book. Job is an upright person, and Job manifesting his righteousness before God in the form of, you know, how many cattle he has and how beautiful his daughters are, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we need to recognise that there's a tension inherent within the text itself. And when we preach text where there's that kind of tension immediately there, the first thing I always think is, well, it's there for a reason, and it's there precisely to remind you that if you come out with a straightforward or kind of easy or glib or cop-out version of what this is all about, everything will be all right in the end, God will solve all of your problems if you just hang on enough or pray hard enough, you've probably misunderstood what's going on. I mean, I read the narrative ending, like at one level it's like it's over the top, it's kind of hyperbole. It's so Job isn't just brought back to where he was, he's brought back to double the reward from where he was, and he gets this kind of extraordinary family, his reputation spreads far and wide. And I mean, my sense of that is the exaggeration might be telling us that this is a very deliberate attempt to over-exaggerate the resolution as a way of saying, this is one way of ending this story, in a kind of pseudo, almost funny way, I think.
Yeah, I was just thinking, would it be blasphemous? That might be a bit strong, but to preach a sermon about what sort of ending you would have for Job, or how do you think this should have ended in the narrative, and how does it end in real life?
Yeah, and I don't think we should be treating this at all as some kind of straightforward representation of
or prescription
an actual life or a prescription. Yeah. It's a way of concluding a story that, for much of its kind of plot development, has taken us deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper into the struggle and the darkness and the conflicts of human experience in relationship to faith in a benevolent and providential God. And I mean, there are two ways of ending that kind of story. You can either get to the bottom of it and stay there, which is what we call tragedy in literary critical terms. We think of that as the plot of tragedy. You know, everyone ends up basically dead on the stage. Or you provide something that provides some kind of resolution, which, again, in literary terms, we would call a comedic structure, the plot of comedy. And this is just a particularly exacerbated version of that resolution, I think.
And it's not, and we've said this before, but it's not a resolution explaining the suffering either. And that's something, you know, although there might be this sort of glib tidy-up happening in the plot, it's, you know, Job maintains his confusion. He admits here his frailty.
Yep. He recants, I think. So it's verse 6 is quite interesting, partly because it's often misused, I think. The NRSV translation there has, "Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." And that verb despise is a really odd verb, kind of very strong. The more recent scholarship on the Hebrew verb there suggests that what it means is Job relents, he recants, he kind of steps back away from his kind of defiant insistence in relationship to God, and recognizes that God is God, that he isn't, and that therefore his experience is not for him to try and control or change in any decisive way. It is what happens to him. Which means that, of course, that the conclusion where life continues is basically, well, life goes on, albeit it now goes on differently. And it's not an instant resolution at all. It takes time to have daughters, and it takes time to gather cattle, and it takes time to build up a new form of life. So it's not an easy answer, I don't think, but it is a pretty exaggerated form of resolution to this incredibly honest story.
Yeah. I wonder whether a preaching theme could be the sort of transformation that is going on here for Job. And something I did read in this, you know, tidy up ending from verse 10 about that transformation is that it is structural to some degree. So he gives his daughter's inheritance, which was pretty unheard of, well, absolutely unheard of at the time.
So he does that. The names of the daughters are quite interesting. Okay. They have these kind of incredibly symbolic names. Jemima means turtle dove. Cassia means Cassia. Keren Hapuk means a kind of form of makeup. There's something kind of symbolic going on in the way that this new situation is constructed. And I don't think it's straightforwardly Job lost this and he's been given it back.
And happily ever after.
Yeah, it's much more of Job lost it. He went through this experience, and the other side of this experience, life developed this way. And that raises the question, well, what the hell was the experience about? Which I think is the point of the book. Yeah. It almost takes you back to the beginning to ask, well, what the heck has been going on, and what's the transformation that's been effected in between?
The other part of the transformation I've just noted earlier than that, verse 10, so the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. So there's something transformational and communal that's happened there too. Yep. That these friends who, in their, you know, with their best of intentions, and we talked about how you might preach on when people come to your suffering with those sort of unhelpful approaches. But he prays, he's forgiven them, presumably.
I think that's right. And, I mean, that's the bit that the lectionary leaves out in verses 7 to 9. So if you're going to preach, you might need to include that as part of the narrative detail. So the resolution isn't just a resolution of Job. It's a resolution that incorporates those who have accompanied him in this journey and have actually been profoundly unhelpful to him in helping him to navigate his way through it because of their distortion of the understanding of the relationship between God and Job's suffering. Yeah.
I'm interested in the vulnerability that Job represents here, and this is probably because I'm currently listening to Willie James Jennings on Audible in his book After Whiteness about theological education, the formation that we're all being made into of whiteness, which is that controlled, you know, powerful and, yes, colonising force, and that vulnerability is so anathema to how we've all been formed. And Job starts off as wealthy, and there is nothing vulnerable about him in the way he's described initially, and yet he has this profound experience. And I think it's worth being explicit about that dynamic in our context.
Well, and maybe the invitation of the conclusion is therefore, okay, you're going to go back to a form of life that was familiar to you from the start of the story. How are you going to do it now, having learned about that vulnerability, having learned about what you can and what you can't control, having learned about how the living of a human life is never something that follows a straight line from, you know,
A to B.
A to B, or from, you know, poverty to blessing, or from bad to good, or et cetera, et cetera. So there's a sense, because the ending of the story evokes the beginning of the story so clearly, it almost feels a bit like the ending of the Gospel of Mark. You know, it's kind of open-ended enough to say, okay, now go back and work out what the hell has been going on in these chapters. And I mean, Job, vulnerability is a good word for Job, I think, and is the product not straightforwardly of his own internal mental processes, but of his constant wrestling with this question of faith in the light of suffering, and his constant wrestling with alternative accounts of what the meaning and significance of that suffering is offered by his friends.
Yeah, well, I was thinking about that with the first sermon focus is, you know, and it's a bit early, but like we do that with recognising the communion of saints sometimes, like who's influenced, who's helped us to come to faith and help to form us, but also how does that happen through an encounter with God, and how does it happen through instruction?
And if we have a breakthrough, if we gain new understanding, if we come to a renewed or a increasingly secure form of faith, how do we carry that in a way that that is inviting, that is open, that doesn't exclude those with whom we've wrestled or those with whom we've had to struggle in the journey so far? I think that's a significant challenge for all sorts of people. They come to a form of renewed conviction, or they come to gain knowledge or wisdom or understanding, but that can easily lead to a form of arrogance, a form of a building of a wall of separation between you and those who haven't been on the same experience and haven't gained the same insights. I think
it makes me want to hear a part two of Job.
Well, scripture is often like this. Of course, we would love to write, the return of Job and his friends, and if there were a Hollywood franchise, no doubt we'd have that.
Oh well, true. Yeah. In terms of that dynamic too of coming to faith, and this is leading into the Mark focus as well. I just am drawing the fairly obvious connection I guess between seeing and hearing. So we've got Job in verse 5.
Yep.
Saying, I heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes sees you. And then we have the healing of the blindness of Bartimaeus. So, again, that theme of coming to faith and how that happens.
And both senses are ways of talking about apprehension of God and apprehension of God's presence and God's deliverance, I think, in both in the Gospel of Mark and in Job. Mm. Yeah.
So should we move across
Yeah, maybe we should move to that.
So this is the last, this is sort of the end of the cycle of healing, and we're just about in Jerusalem. I gather Jericho's 15 miles or something.
Not too far away.
Not too far.
And we're at the last story before the beginning of Mark's passion narrative, for want of a better word. Therefore it marks a kind of major pivot. In the structure of Mark's gospel, it's true that basically, Mark is a game of two halves. There's everything that leads up to Peter's confession at Caesarea Philippi, and there's everything that comes after that in the journey towards Jerusalem. But in that second half, there's a clear demarcation at the point, effectively, where Jesus' public ministry and his healings come to an end, and it really becomes a narrative about Jesus and the disciples in the face of hostile opposition from the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem. So this is the final story in that public ministry, and other than Jesus teaching in the temple, and therefore it probably has some significance of Mark, not least because as Jesus starts to make his way towards Jerusalem, we have another healing of the blind man story. So there are two healing of the blind stories that frame this travel narrative in Mark as Jesus makes his way.
I was really struck. I was reading some of Ched Meyers' work on this, the correlation or the comparison he draws with the hemorrhaging woman story with this one, so that the hindering work of the crowd, like the crowd is a character. I think we've said that before in this in this gospel. The commendation of faith is quite similar in both of them.
Yep.
And the theme of ritual impurity with the bleeding woman and with Bartimaeus. Now, Bartimaeus, I understand, can mean the son of the unclean in Hebrew. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. And I think it means, but we need to be careful about this language of impurity.
Yes.
And particularly about how we understand Jesus' attitude towards it. It's not a fundamental theme in this passage, but it's implicit here and in a number of others. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to say, you know, Jesus wanted nothing to do with that purity system because, you know, it was some kind of bad Jewish thing that he realized was kind of out of date and superseded. And that's not really what's going on in these stories. It's not impurity, and Jewish models of dealing with impurity are by definition a bad thing.
Right, yep.
What Jesus confronts is what causes the impurity in the first place, which is basically these powers of sickness and disease and death that Jesus and the reign and the kingdom of God that Jesus brings confront.
Yep. So this is significant, this story too, because the son of David nomenclature is given to Jesus by Bartimaeus, which is both correct in terms of being built around the Jewish expectation, but not.
It's another messianic term.
Yeah.
It's interesting, of course, within the overall plot of the Gospel of Mark, because in the Gospel of Mark earlier, when people have got close to saying that Jesus is the Messiah, Jesus tells them to be quiet. This is the messianic secret motif, which we have earlier in Mark.
Yeah, yeah.
Here, after Jesus has revealed that he's not only the Messiah but also the suffering Son of Man, which the disciples themselves don't understand, Bartimaeus says, "You are the Son of David," gives him this messianic attribution, and it's many sternly ordered him. It's the crowds who tell him that he ought to be quiet. Yeah. So this idea that Jesus' messiahship, as Jesus gets closer to Jerusalem, is becoming more and more available for kind of public understanding is really important, and Bartimaeus therefore becomes a kind of very clearly a proto-discipleship figure for any number of reasons.
I mean, he's very persistent. He cried even more loudly. He's the one with the initiative here, totally. And we really probably need to highlight the question that Jesus asks him, "What do you want me to do for you?" Which is exactly the question that Jesus put to James and John, who then proceeded to say what sort of leadership they'd like. Thank you very much.
That's right. Just in a bit earlier on in this chapter, and it's in the same chapter. That's right. And this detail of him throwing off his cloak and springing up and coming to Jesus, evocative of the disciples leaving behind their nets to go and follow after Jesus.
And also, doesn't it show up the rich man who was shocked and grieved and went away? And this, presumably, this man only has his cloak and he's dispensing with it without being asked.
That's exactly right. And, and you know, in the ancient world, a cloak is not simply a kind of, you know, incidental item of clothing. It's fundamental to, you know, human warmth and human dignity and other things. So there are all sorts of markers in this passage that, while it's clearly a healing story, primarily, actually, it's a story about discipleship. And a particularly challenging story because it's about the way in which this blind person on the road to Jericho understands something about Jesus' identity and Jesus' purpose in going to Jerusalem and is prepared to follow him on that journey, whereas the 12 don't.
No, and most of the other healings, am I right, they go off. They're told to go off. Jesus says go off somewhere else.
Yep, that's right.
Whereas Bartimaeus just gets up and follows without being told. He does not told to go elsewhere and he doesn't get asked to come to Jerusalem. He just does it naturally.
That's right. So this language of going on the way has been consistent language for Jesus and the disciples as they made their way towards Jerusalem. And it has symbolic overtones of the motif of discipleship and obedience for Mark. So Bartimaeus is right there and in the midst of it. And as the passion narrative unfolds, of course, that question about who will continue to follow Jesus on the way will become an increasingly important question as the disciples start to fall away.
I'm interested that there are no blind women. We'll talk about the motif of blindness in a minute and, you know, perhaps problems with talking glibly about that. But there's no blind women in Mark in these stories either. And I don't know, I just got thinking about that dynamic, gender dynamic in Mark's gospel when I was reading this one this week.
I think that's an interesting question to contemplate. I'm racking my mind back through Mark's gospel. I mean, of course, you have the healing of the woman, the hemorrhaging woman.
Yeah, yeah.
Jairus's daughter. You then have the healing of the Syrophoenician woman's daughter. So there are female characters, but to a certain extent, they're often off camera. They're often not the main character in the encounter with Jesus himself. So I don't know what we make of that. The thing about healing stories is quite clearly, as these stories were told, they kind of developed a bit of a kind of coherent shape that was pretty similar across the board. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why we do see points of connection and similarity, I think, is because, you know, in particularly in the period of the oral tradition when these stories were told, they did assume some kind of narrative form that was pretty easy to remember, that quite clearly moved from, you know, the initial point of encounter, the word of transformation, and then the resolution. What's striking, though, of course, is they all do that in slightly different ways.
It's a basic formula.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So I just flagged, the attention that we should really pay when we're reading these stories where disability is a theme.
Yeah.
And we haven't talked about this, even though we have had these stories of blindness over the last few weeks. And I'm reminded of Kylie Crabb's work in this area, and I'll put a link to a Uniting Church page where there's one of her lectures or addresses to our synod about it. But just that these figures with disability can become, I suppose, she uses the phrase narrative prostheses, which she quotes from someone else, but that they're sort of just useful in the narrative and not, and we don't know them very well.
Yeah.
You know, they become tools. And just to think about our language of normality and to critique how we understand what that means. And, for example, that most of us will have a level of disability in our lives, perhaps most of our lives.
So I think that the I mean, one way of doing that, there are some strategies I think you can use to help yourself, help to be alert to that question and the potential problems. If you simply say, you know, this man has something wrong with him, he can't see, and Jesus fixes it. I mean, that's the problematic interpretation of this text. And one way of avoiding it, of course, is to say, yes, like a number of characters, we don't know much about any of the disciples, actually, in other than perhaps Peter in terms of narrative detail. But like many of the characters, yes, they are kind of detached and not in 3D full focus. They're playing a role within the narrative. But the role that this man is playing is not sick man who gets healed. It's person who responds to Jesus and becomes disciple. And so that positive construction of the fact that what's really important about this person is not their blindness, but is actually their faith. And this is a story about how that faith, what that faith looks like, how it is a person's life is transformed and oriented towards faith and discipleship through an encounter with Jesus. This man becomes some kind of epitome of those qualities in the Gospel of Mark.
He has a centrality to him, therefore, you know, as is the centre of our faith, one who suffers and suffers with. So, just I think emphasising that rather than, and making note of it, you know, if you have a visually impaired person in your congregation, how you speak about this matters.
I mean, the healing story, I mean, my view of the healing stories is that the reason for the preservation of the healing stories in early Christian memories about Jesus has almost nothing to do with the fact that Jesus healed sick people. And one of the reasons for that is because we know that there were other healers. We know that there were other miracle workers. The fact that Jesus had a reputation for healing the sick is not actually a terribly interesting thing about him within early Christian memory. What's important in the memory tradition is that these stories are remembered as pointers. First of all, they're Christological in their orientation. They point to something about the identity of Jesus himself. And then secondly, they draw out these motifs of discipleship in significant and important ways. So
and that whole first will be last thing, I mean, that's what's happening.
Yeah, so the idea that there are these characters, women or those who are by the side of the road,
the marginalized,
that they are the characters who actually embody and epitomize mark and characteristics of discipleship, I think is a really significant thing and something that should always be drawn out.
Yep. So an interesting sermon might be, is your prayer, Lord, help me see again?
Yeah. But you come back to then your point earlier. Once you recognise that the faith is the most important thing, then the motif of sight becomes something much more. It can take on those more symbolic and metaphorical significances, I think. And here again, it relates to, you know, there's something that he hears, it's in the go your faith has made you well. It's that word that then leads to the recovery of sight. Yeah. So those motifs operate in the same way.
Well, I think that will tie us together for this week, Sean. Thanks for co-hosting for these last few weeks. Sean will be back, no doubt, folks, but Rachel Kronberger will be in the co-host chair next week.
That's great. Thanks, Fran. Nice to see you.
By the Well has been recorded on Wurundjeri land. It's produced by Adrian Jackson and brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College and the Uniting Church in Australia.